Hello and welcome to Morning Energy Live. I'm your host, Andrew Gillick, and with me today is Ben Dell, founder and managing partner at Kimmeridge, private equity firm focused on the energy sector with about $5 billion under management. He also serves as chairman of Caturus, an export facility in Louisiana, and CEO of Chestnut Carbon, a Kimmeridge-backed company focused on nature-based carbon removal solutions. Prior to launching Kimmeridge, Ben built a hybrid technical finance career, first at BP, where he worked in M&A and finance, and earlier as an exploration geophysicist and geologist, already more degrees than I can count, great, in several of BP's regional business units. After BP, he became a senior equity research analyst at Sanford Bernstein, covering E&P, often earning top rankings in II's annual surveys. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right, before we start, Ben, I got five questions for you so the listeners can get to know you a little bit better. Good.
Sounds good.
All right, let's go. So, Ben, what was the first concert you ever went to?
I think that was Paul Simon with Bob Dylan in the Woodlands.
No. That's
Yeah.
awesome. Well, now I'm jealous. All right, so what all right, next question. Beach or mountains? What do you prefer here? Now, is a year-round commitment, not seasonal. Where are you gonna go?
I think mountains, and largely because the mountains are underappreciated in summer.
I agree. The mountains are beautiful in the summer. For me, it's just hard to stay away from the ocean. So, we'll have to disagree on that one. All right. I have a guess here, but have you been to more states or more countries?
I've been to 46 states, but I'd have to say countries.
Countries. Working with BP, traveling around the world, I guess that makes sense. All right, here's a good one. Who do you admire most professionally?
That's going to be a hard question. I feel like I need more time on that one. I'm going to pass on that one.
Ooh, all right. Well, maybe we can come back to it later in the show if something inspires you to share a story. All right, and then the last, and actually the most important question, what is the best sandwich?
I think that one's easier. I'd say French dip, either at RH Guesthouse or Four Charles.
I like the
Big
very
fan of the French
specific
dip.
French diff. That is a good sandwich. I agree. All right. Well, that was great. Thank you very much for that. All right. So before we dig into some of the topics that I know the folks have tuned in to hear about, maybe you could share a little bit about what motivated you to found Kimmeridge.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, if you look at my background, I'd been in the oil and gas space since the beginning. I was obviously a geologist coming out of college, worked for BP. I was lucky enough in BP to work on the exploration side and then the M&A side. And I went to Bernstein as Bernstein was starting up its European office on the sell side. And I think after being on the sell side for nearly a decade, you come to the conclusion that if you of it. I mean, obviously, involved in, and myself and Neil have been mapping out the Barnett and mapping out particularly the Pennsylvania Appalachian shales. And so to me, that was sort of the driver to get back into it and put real money to work.
Got it. And so you started off, how did it start off? I know because today you have both public and private strategies within Kimmeridge. Where was the beginning?
The beginning was really on the private side. When we first went out into the market, the goal was to build a private equity fund focused on direct investment in oil and gas assets. And fund one was really just two assets. Fund two was sort of the first fully diversified portfolio. And our goal was to go out, lease, develop, and ultimately flip these projects. I think if you go back when we started, 2012, 2015, it was sort of the run-up in the lease aggregation play. So some of our first projects were, I think, Illinois, which didn't work. And then We ended up in the Permian, obviously on the Delaware side, in Culberson and Reeves County. So that was sort of the origin of the business.
Bold of you to, I'd forgotten Illinois was even a spot where we had been looking for shale, but I guess it's everywhere. It's just how prolific it is. But Delaware certainly touch better. Well, so one of the early calls on the industry that you made and that I think people know Kimmeridge for is consolidation. And as we kind of came to the end of that decade. So why is that so important to you? Like some would argue consolidation stifles innovation. So how do you reconcile that with your thesis?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I would say is the US E&P industry today is still highly disaggregated. Certainly, when you look at it in the context of tech, financials, insurance, telecom, really, you go across almost any other industry, and it has a higher degree of concentration that you see in the energy space today. I think the stats are if you took the energy industry and consolidated it four more times, so cut everything in half. Four more times, you still wouldn't have the concentration you have in airlines. So I think the first thing to say is I don't think innovation would really be stifled by more consolidation. When we started this sort of narrative back in 2016, 2015, and I remember the PDC campaign very vividly, you know, it was a thematic that the industry fought against. I remember that original presentation on PDC was, we wanted them to generate a return on capital above their cost of capital. Obviously, a really aggressive thought process. We wanted management paid in line with shareholders. We wanted consolidation, and we wanted them to get their costs and G&A down. I mean, if you look at it now, I think everyone in the industry buys into that thesis. But look, there's still a lot of consolidation to be done. I still think there's a lot of companies operating in the same basin with overlap that don't need to exist. And I think we'll continue to see it.
And do you think that the wave of consolidation that we saw last year now pauses, or we should just next 12 months continue to see more? Like, what's the mood out there in terms of willingness to do this?
Well, I think it's really a question of which basins you're looking at. Obviously, if you take the DJ, there's really not that much room for additional consolidation. I think in the Bakken, there's a little Appalachia, there's probably one or two more transactions that could happen in the sequence. The big basin to me that has obvious consolidation is the Delaware. And still the Eagle Ford, I think, is relatively disaggregated. It's been interesting in the Haynesville recently, all the transactions we've been seeing on the gas side haven't been bought by incumbents. So we've actually had this really high degree of turnover in a basin like the Haynesville, but unusually, none of the incumbent players have been the buyers. So I think there's been a little shift in the gas market where the buyers of assets are new buyers coming from the international arena. Where, you know, historically in that M&A, we've been seeing people doing in-basin transactions.
Do you think that that's a function of the international players who, many of which have liquefaction capacity on the Gulf Coast, are worried about getting their volumes at some point in the future? Is that why they're buying the molecules in the ground?
I think there's two things at play. One is, and we did this analysis a while back, if you look at liquefaction capacity, you can work out who's net short US gas and who's net long US gas. And clearly, there are a lot of people buying liquefaction who own liquefaction capacity who are net short. You know, the obvious one right now that you'd talk about would be Woodside, you know, massively net short US gas. The other element I think drives it is that on the international arena, people are seeing power demand go up, much like we're seeing domestically here. When you look at that, the question is, well, if you want to limit power price inflation, the easiest way to do it is to lock in your resource base in the US, because either US gas prices are going to rise, or what you're going to see is that you can hold your power price down on the international market. So I think a lot of the people like the JERAs and the Japanese buyers, the Tokyo Gases, are looking at this as a hedge to domestic power pricing.
That makes sense. You started talking about, or we're talking about the LNG markets, and so anybody who's been watching Kimmeridge, pretty clear today your thesis on North American natural gas. And So what are the main drivers today in your thesis and the way that you've approached the market, both upstream and I guess midstream, downstream,
Yeah, I
all
think
streams,
all streams. I think
all streams.
you have to step back a little bit and say, in 2016, the US gas market was a domestic gas market. People sold their gas at the wellhead, and that was all you really needed to do. If you look at today, we truly have a global gas market. If you look at JKM, if you look at TTF, so the Asian and European benchmarks for LNG, and you back out transportation costs, regas costs, liquefaction costs and gas purchasing costs. Essentially, Henry Hub, JKM Net, and TTF Net sit on top of each other. So we have a global gas market already. Now, that changes a little bit whether you're in the summer season or the winter season. But if you think about that gas molecule when it leaves the wellhead, whether it's going through pipe, whether it's the differentials, whether it's the liquefaction business, whether it's trading and optimizing the boats on the water, or whether it's optimizing between an FOB and a DES contract with the buyer in the end market, you have a huge amount of real option value that sit within that stack where you can clear incremental margin. And I would argue in the last 5, 10 years, most of that margin has been given away to the likes of the Vitols, the Glencores, the Trafigura, and the Mercurias of the world. And they've been very good at monetizing that. It's been extremely profitable for them. We've also seen even the utility buyers, the Tokyo Gases, et cetera, with their trading businesses like Arm, build out those footprints and optimize it. But what's been really amazing is the big US upstream suppliers, have really not connected with their customer, right? Have not talked directly to them. Now, in fairness to EQT, I think they've identified this, and you're seeing EQT more and more go direct to the customer. So whether that's the LNG buyer or the power consumer, they're building more integration across that value chain. But I would still say 90 to 95% of all the big US gas producers are just sitting in their domestic bubble, really not understanding where their consumer is and what they're willing to pay.
So what, I mean, what is it from stopping them? Is it just, no, this is the way we've always done it? No, this is too hard. What's the, why not reach out to the end consumer?
Well, look, I think the first thing to say is the LNG business is complicated. It's expensive. It's high barrier to entry. And you really have to go out and commit and build a global footprint in it. From our side, we just brought on Tim Wyatt, who had come from Cheniere and Hanwha, has tremendous experience in the space. And look, I think you've seen EQT go out and do that. Look at multiple liquefaction. You see Toby out in the Middle East, out in Asia, talking to the customer base. But it's a real commitment. I think boards historically have been nervous about getting into areas they don't understand, whether that's power or LNG. And I think gas players domestically have had a checkered history. So if you look at the case of Expand, this is a company that was in bankruptcy. Right. So I think there's a fair degree of conservatism built into these boards, and it will take them time to understand the margin leakage that you're seeing on an international basis.
So what are the baby steps that they could take, I guess that would be next, if you're not jumping in feet first to the whole value chain.
Yeah, look, I think the baby steps are taking some liquefaction capacity. The baby steps are building out your domestic gas trading books. I mean, it's even amazing now when you look at the big gas players how relatively small their gas trading operations are. The BPs, the Conocos of the world have big gas trading platforms. It would be partnering up with local utilities from the power generation side of the business. That's another very obvious where you can go into joint ventures and sort of tiptoe into the space and just learn what the how the power business is really evolving. So I think there's lots of different ways of doing it. I mean, look, one of the advantages of being private is that you can make these moves, you can set out your 5 and 10 year strategy and go out to execute them, and you don't have to worry about the quarterly volatility in the public.
Oh, come on. You miss the quarterly volatility in the public market. Earnings, staying up late, listening to the calls, asking the same question over and over again.
I thought
No?
your AI models were going to do quarterly earnings now.
We're getting there. We're getting there. Well, so it sounds like there's a lot of benefits, or there's one major benefit to this integration, and that's being able to capture margin. Can you give us a sense of that scale, or how you're thinking
Yeah, I
about it?
mean, I'll give you some very simple examples. If you have $4 Henry Hub and the average gas player has a 75% cash margin, just for example, what we see is on a just optimizing your gas on a global basis, the ability to go to TTF, JKM, Brent, or domestically is worth around $1.50 in MCF incremental on your margin. So that's a 50% margin uplift. I think about it like this. Even if you look at your domestic gas trading and optimizing it between Henry Hub, Houston Ship, Waha, AECO, I mean, within that, we're talking in some cases $2 an MCF of spread, or 40 cents when you look at Houston Ship versus Henry Hub. So there's very obvious ways you can go after this margin environment. Now, look, there's also more on trading and optimizing your boats. When you think about moving a boat, very simplistically, I give this example. If you have a contract to pick up at Gulf of Mexico and you're delivering, sorry, Gulf of America, and you're delivering it into Asia, and you can find a way to pick up a cargo in the Middle East, deliver it into Asia, and divert your cargo to South America, you can save $1 an MCF net on overall shipping. So these are big margins that can be captured once you go downstream at the wellhead.
Basis in boats, capturing the margins. I like it.
It's the title of your next research piece,
It
I
might
think.
be. I'm taking notes here for, good ideas for morning energy. So as this new global gas market evolves and LNG becomes a bigger part of it, do you see a risk of overbuilding? Or do you see a political or regulatory backlash as a real risk if LNG exports start to drive up domestic pricing?
Yeah, I think the hard part of the U.S. gas market right now is understanding the long-term demand outlook. We all look at LNG, we can map that out. Invariably in LNG, there will be delays. I mean, the nature of the business lends itself to delays in construction and delivery. And I actually think the nervousness about the 29-30 LNG market is also going to moderate some of these capacity additions that are coming through. The real question I have, and I think the hardest part to forecast in the gas market, is where does power demand end up? And I say that because it depends on your view on interconnects, transmissions, gas turbine deliveries, how much of the data centers ultimately get built, what efficiency gains do you see in compute? And I think candidly, I'm not smart enough to have an answer to that, but the range of outcomes is very wide, right? I think you could sit here and say it's 2 BCF or 10 BCF a day of incremental demand. So look, I think there is growth in the gas market. The gas market is a growth business on a global basis. We expect global gas to double by 2050. I think when you look at the political situation, power prices and gas are going to become a political hot potato, I think, as we go towards the next election. And the reason I say that is you can sort of see the headline now, which is your power price is up and unemployment's up, your job's being taken by AI. This is terrible, and you should vote, for the other party. I can see how that narrative takes hold. I think even if you look at it in microcosms, where you go to small areas where there's big data centers and power prices are going up, you're seeing that locally. Now, look, the reality is the problem here is permitting and regulations and how many different agencies have to get involved in everything that we're doing, which has made building out transmission, power, distributed power, like really hard. But I think it's going to be interesting to watch the escalation in power prices and the growth in AI and what that leads to from a political standpoint.
How many miles of transmission did you say we've built year to date
I think
earlier?
62 miles this year, and at the peak back in the 2000s, it was 4,000.
So
So, I
more
mean,
transmission would be helpful in a growing demand environment versus a flat demand environment.
look, I think everybody sees the scenario here, which is we have a lot of power. Our power is generally in the wrong place. It is not optimized. And if you can optimize that power grid, both in terms of the distributed power grid, the home, but overall the interconnectivity within the US, there's a massive opportunity to actually bring down power prices for the consumer.
Well, I guess the incumbent party has about a year to figure out this permitting thing to see if they can get those power prices to at least suggest that they're coming in down.
Yeah, look, I think it's challenging. I mean, we talked about it earlier. Chris Wright has made comments around FERC and permitting, but this isn't just federal, right? This is federal, state, local, in some cases parishes, and it, yeah, and it makes it extremely difficult because you have these multiple layers of stacked regulatory approval.
So it's really not about whether we have enough natural gas domestically to not worry about shipping internationally. It's about being able to have the actual power capacity so that prices don't move higher in a way that makes it hard for folks to eat.
I don't worry about gas inventory. I mean, for me, when I look at it, probably the biggest frontier that we're testing and I think will continue to grow is deep gas. I mean, what we're doing in the Eagle Ford now, you know, drilling 15, 20 BCF wells for $10.5 million, 14,000 feet, you know, high pressure, high temperature gas. And obviously what you see with a Comstock in the Waynesville, you know, I see a big resource in deep gas. It's one where operational execution can really drive performance. So I don't really worry about the resource base in gas. I think it's very different in oil, right? You don't have that movement in the oil side of the business, but in gas, I think you have a pretty significant supply base that can deliver in at $4 to $5 an MCF. I mean, I always make the statement over the last 20 years, the one commodity that never inflates has been natural gas. Look, I think that is the challenge, which is getting the gas and converting it into electrons and getting those electrons in the right location, which is candidly why you've seen data centers move towards the resource base and not the other way around, right? It's why Meta is building north of the Haynesville. It's why data centers are moving into Texas and West Texas, because it's easier to move the data center than it is to move the electrons, which is kind of insane.
A lot of gas in West Texas. It's like free too, so it's a good place to put your power plant. That said, your upstream right now is focused in South Texas, in the Eagle Ford. What is it about the Eagle Ford versus the Haynesville or the MidCon that's more appealing to you? And is it this deep gas? Are you focused in that area too, or you know, what are you thinking?
Yeah, ultimately, when we invest in any asset, it's about being front end of the cost curve and having the lowest cost resource. When I look at our F&D costs, and Dave Lawler and his team have done a tremendous job operationally, you know, we're pushing now 90 cents on the F&D side. Now, I think that's competitive with any asset in the U.S., but when you put that asset in the shortest position distance to market to get to international gas markets, it becomes highly competitive. And ultimately, that's why we've been building out that position. We're over 200,000 acres now. Very consistent well performance in the Eagle Ford and the Austin Chalk. And that's the driver for us. I mean, when you look at Commonwealth on the LNG side, why are we in Commonwealth? Because it's a modular build, and we believe modular builds are structurally lower cost than stick build. So really, whatever we do, we want to be in the lowest cost source of supply, whether it's on the oil side, the gas side, the LNG. And that really builds the resilience so that when you go through these down cycles, you can continue to deliver your business plan. And also what you can deliver is the highest growth on a debt adjusted per share basis.
Maybe real quick for folks, could you explain the difference between modular build and not modular build?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately the question is, are you building this unit internationally in a shipyard that's dedicated to building large scale construction items and then bringing it in by boat and then assembling it in country, or are you building it part by part in country? And you know, that second part, building it part by part in country, becomes very expensive. The logistics are much more challenging, and in part because you don't have a labor force that's designed to turn up on that location every day to do the same job.
Got it. So the first one you said was the modular build.
Yep.
Got it. No, that totally makes sense. And they ramp up faster too, I heard. And so, okay, back to the Eagle Ford. What you described is not the deep gas areas that you see. You see that more as a future play for gas in North
I
America
mean,
or in the United States?
right now we're testing 12.5, 13, 14,000 feet. But I do think you can go deeper in many areas. You obviously get hotter once you go over 350 degrees. It makes certain elements of the drilling challenging. You end up with more pressure, which has generally been good. And also the question is, what's the purity of your gas? You do pick up some additional CO2 as you go deeper. But I think there's lots of deep gas plays that exist across the US, and we've only really started to skim the surface of them.
If you really get too high, you just throw a geothermal site right next door and more power. I mean, you're just going to win all over the place, Ben. one of the partners that you have in development here is Mubadala. What's the benefit of having a partner like that, an international partner, in your projects?
Yeah, I mean, look, we're very excited to have Mubadala in with us. I think, at least in my view, when you look at the macro, which is understanding how the growth in AI impacts the growth in GDP, and how the growth in AI is driven by power delivery and the availability of low-cost energy, I would say the three countries that really understand that are the US, the UAE, and China. So when you look at the UAE, it obviously has a massive capital base that it's willing to put to work. I think you have extremely sophisticated investors who understand the big long-term thematics and are willing to invest in them. And for us, they've been a really good tried and tested partner. We obviously talk about the deal we did this year, but we've been working with Abu Dhabi and the investment funds out there since 2016. So this is really the just one step along what I believe is a long-term relationship and a commitment to the region.
Great. You have an investor who understands the business both from the energy standpoint, but what that energy is serving in the power and technology sectors going forward. So, less time on the LP calls explaining things, I guess, is good.
Yeah, they're pretty sophisticated.
That's good. Nice. So, we have a little bit of time left, and I'd be remiss if we didn't touch on one of the other areas that I know you're quite passionate about, and it's on the carbon side, and you formed a company called Chestnut Carbon. Tell us a little bit about that, and what you think about the voluntary environmental attribute market and how that might evolve.
Sure. I mean, one of the things we talk about internally is what's the optimal solution in terms of power generation. I think our view is in most markets, that's a combination of gas, solar, battery, and then decarbonizing your footprint. When I was involved with Civy and we wanted to make Civy the first net zero E&P, we went out and looked at how do you buy carbon credits, how do you offset your footprint. And we originally built a cost curve for our emissions, and we looked at bringing down 60% of those emissions by investment, and then you end up with a stub that you couldn't remove. And when you looked to the carbon market, it was really hard to find high quality carbon removal credits. I think it, quite frankly, still is. And when I think about carbon removal, if you're paying someone to store carbon, you need to know that A, it's being stored, the amount that's being stored, and that it's going to be stored there for the period that you're paying for it. Now, whether that's underground, whether it's in a tank, or whether it's in a tree, this should be a molecular equation. You know how much carbon is stored, and you want certainty that that carbon is stored in perpetuity. For us, the cheapest way of delivering that was afforestation. So buying non-performing farmland, restoring it back to forests. And then because we own the land, we know it's there in perpetuity. And look, to give you the example, people will say, well, a tree dies. How do you know it's there in perpetuity? If you have 1,000 trees and one tree dies and an incremental tree grows, the ultimate storage tank is still 999 or 1,000. It might fluctuate up or down 0.1%, but you essentially know that forest is in position. And we know that forests have been in existence for tens of thousands of years, and there's great statistical data on this. So for me, this was the cheapest way of delivering this. Not only that, it delivers a ton of code benefits back to the communities. We make the properties available for people to hunt, fish, enjoy as part of that process. So we went out and built that business. We now have over 60,000 acres. We've acquired over, I think, 30,000 acres planted, 19 million trees. You know, they're truly conservation projects. And, you know, to me, it's been one of the really rewarding pieces of businesses. And we obviously just did the first project financing of that, which is also a sort of financial first in the space.
That's pretty exciting. I mean, we, you know, the last couple of years, we've heard lots of ESG noise and different ways that investors and folks who are trying to reduce their carbon footprint were trying to deploy capital into the space. All that sort of quieted down over the last, you know, nine months or so. But that doesn't mean, and I think you know this better than I do, that the largest companies aren't still focused on reducing their carbon footprint, right? The trick is, to your point, is like, how do you know it's there? And so the markets today are voluntary. Is there something that needs to change to make this easier for corporates to invest in these projects, or are we sort of moving along a path that's okay?
I think it's okay. I'd rather have the market develop and then be regulated rather than the government step in and say, this is how it's going to be. I think the mistake we made with this market is carbon removal is expensive, true carbon removal. And when I say expensive, I think that clearing cost is somewhere between $70 and $150 a ton. There's obviously techniques, mechanisms that are above that point that could potentially come down. But I think we've been unrealistic in sort of saying, oh, there's some low-cost nirvana of how to remove carbon. The reality is that it's, $70, $150 a ton, and we don't need every company to remove 100% of their footprint tomorrow. We want to encourage them to reduce their footprint, which I think a lot of industry is doing because they view it as good business. And we want them to take the really expensive portion that it would be really hard for them to abate. And we want to give them a mechanism where they can offset that by buying genuine carbon removal credits. But I think if we can clear up the market so that what's being sold on the market is true carbon removal, and I make this argument all the time, the carbon removal market and the avoidance market, which is by definition a counterfactual market, those two markets have to separate. Yeah, right. I didn't cut down this tree, so you should pay me for it, is an avoidance credit, and that should be a separate market to I went and took a tank and filled it up with CO2 and stored it there in perpetuity.
Right. The other one is sort of the first is questionable. It's like, okay, you didn't cut down a tree. You know, how long are you not going to cut down the tree for? Is somebody else going to cut down the tree?
It's not a bad thing to pay someone to not cut down a tree. It's just you shouldn't be paying them for removing carbon at the same rate as someone
who's doing carbon removal.
They're different products.
Totally. No, that makes sense. Okay. So as we're sort of wrapping up here a little bit, when you look back maybe a decade from now, what do you hope Kimmeridge will have changed, whether it's about the industry or the market, or the climate conversation? It seems like you have very, strong ideas about, where things should be moving. 10 years, where will we be?
If we achieve anything in the next 10 years, my goal would be to bring pragmatism back to the discussion.
All right.
I say this all the time. I think everybody wants the same thing, low cost power and energy on demand with the smallest possible carbon footprint. I don't see myself on either extreme. And I think Chris Wright sort of phrased this one way, which is you've got this choice between your environmental category and energy poverty. There's still a billion people in energy poverty, and telling them that they can't use coal, gas, or oil, doesn't make a lot of sense when you're in energy poverty. So I think just bringing pragmatism back to the discussion, we will get a lot further if we're pragmatic, if we understand that gas is part of the solution, nuclear is part of the solution, that we need a competitive market driven by economics in terms of adding those power solutions, how batteries play into the space. But, on the very extreme ends of both sides, there's this sort of ideological belief system, which candidly only goes to impair progress for anyone. And honestly, for operators in the space, whether you're upstream, renewable infrastructure, batteries, or LNG, it's the whipsawing between the extremities that make investment incredibly difficult. So if I achieve anything, it's hopefully to bring people towards a more pragmatic middle where we can deliver all of the above, where we can try and keep power prices in check, and we can minimize the carbon footprint associated with it.
I like that. And I think that you've certainly started moving the discussion in that direction. So appreciate that. All right, now at risk of maybe offending some of my clients, because I know some of the questions you want to ask me, what's one question, Ben, that you would like to ask me?
So the question I wanted to ask you, which you were dancing around, was what is the worst M&A transaction by two energy companies in our space that you, which is the one you wouldn't have done?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I appreciate, I don't appreciate you asking me. So as I thought through, look, there's been some great deals. There have been some expensive deals. There have been some deals that you could argue weren't as strategic for the company as much as it was for the executives at the company doing the deal. And unfortunately, we've seen a lot of that. But I think, you know, I'm going to answer your question a little differently. I think the deal that didn't happen, the worst deal that didn't happen, was Silverbow not selling to Kimmeridge, Texas Gas. That, I think,
that's such a cop
was
out.
Big cop out. I know. I think compliance ears popped up when you asked that question. let's check out. Well, anyway, Ben, this has been great. Thank you very much. I really enjoyed the discussion, and I look forward to continuing the pragmatic discussion around the energy sector. So, thank you.
Appreciate the time. Thank you.